The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, there's a webinar today sponsored by the IIEA and Janssen, and it's talking about cancer and cancer care across Europe. And could a pan-European approach to cancer care and research result in better outcomes in this country? Well, joining me now, we have Rachel Morrow, who is the Executive Director of Advocacy and External Relations with the Irish Cancer Society, and Professor and Consultant Medical Oncologist at St. Vincent's University Hospital, John Crown. Good morning. Good morning and welcome to you both. John Crown, first of all, this Europe's Beating Cancer Plan, there are four planks: prevention, screening, fair access to healthcare, and support for those who are afflicted by cancer. They're kind of the broad headlines.
Yes, Pat. It's the specifics of it are that there's apparently going to be approximately 4 billion earmarked of EU funding to try and advance this. Now, if we're doing a per capita back-of-the-envelope calculation, I guess that would give us about 40 million in Ireland. It's ambitious. I mean, it's very worthy. It could perhaps be criticized for being a little bit aphoristic and a little bit low on specifics, but certainly it's very good, I think, for focusing the mind on what the important issues are in terms of improving care, improving early diagnosis and prevention, a big focus on prevention in areas like smoking, alcohol, healthier eating, a move towards a more plant-based diet. It'll be interesting to see how that clashes with the other great EU force, which, of course, is the agricultural lobby, if they'll be able to, if I'm not mixing too many metaphors here, lock horns with the beef industry on that one.
But are they general, still subsidizing tobacco production in Greece and places like that?
I don't know if they are, but certainly there's a very strong anti-tobacco message in this. I think one thing from the specific Irish point of view that we have to be aware of is that this particular program is focusing on one of the key planks that we should have a network across Europe of what are called comprehensive cancer centers. This is something I started advocating for 30 years ago, which is a relatively small number of large, muscular, truly comprehensive cancer treatment facilities, which would give, you know, all of the kinds of cancer treatment, prevention, research, you know, in a one-stop shop under one roof, allowing a critical concentration of resources. And I believe we made a very historical error in Ireland when we had the much vaunted quote-unquote centers of excellence strategy many years ago not to do this. Rather unusually, a decision was made that Ireland collectively, that Dublin collectively would be seen as one comprehensive cancer center with many component hospitals doing colon cancer here and prostate cancer there and breast cancer there and there. And it was a mistake. It was a bad mistake. And hopefully this will help focus minds on the need to
reform that. What should have been done? Instead of that, what should have been done?
Well, a city the size of Dublin should have had a small number of truly comprehensive cancer treatment facilities, perhaps something like 1, 2, or 3 comprehensive cancer treatment facilities for a city the size of our capital. I believe Cork is evolving towards having something along the correct lines. The size of the city probably lends itself to that a bit more than was the case in Dublin. In Dublin, the presence of 3 medical schools, you know, rapidly changing administrative visions about how the health service in Dublin should be carved up between health boards, health groups, hospital groups, something which seems to change approximately every 5 years. The bureaucracy changes its attitude to it. Did not lend itself to appropriate planning on that, but we can still get it right if we try.
When you're talking about pan-European efforts, are there problems with accreditation? If you've got someone who's working in France or in Latvia on cancer care, could they come to Dublin if they knew something that we didn't quite know, or if they had a procedure that we didn't know quite what to do? Would they be free under the rules to actually come over and practice here for a while?
In general, graduates of EU medical schools and people who are registered in EU countries have a relatively smooth passage to getting registration in Ireland. Certainly at junior doctor level, at non-consultant level, it does become a little bit trickier at consultant level. And I think we've been, we made another historic mistake we made about 15 years ago was trying to centralize too much and domesticate too much of our senior specialist training across all the specialties of medicine in Ireland. This was an attempt to play catch up because we didn't have good registration structures here with internal training plans. Most Irish doctors traditionally had gone internationally to centres of excellence in the UK or the US, overwhelmingly also Canada and Australia, to acquire very senior specialist training. This had a real positive spin-off effect for a country like Ireland, which was in real danger of becoming totally peripheralized. And it has caused certain restrictions, I think, and made it a little bit less attractive for graduates of other EU countries and trainees who've done their senior training in other EU jurisdictions to get on the Irish specialist register. That's an administrative thing, and that could be fixed.
Yeah, it'll have to happen if this plan is to be realised. Rachel Morrow of the Irish Cancer Society, what difference would injecting 40 million or thereabouts into Irish cancer research and treatment, what difference do you think it would make?
Hi, Pat. Hi, John. I think there is like a significant potential in the plan. I think that the challenges posed by COVID, and it's in the news today about complex surgeries being cancelled in some of Ireland's cancer centres, and the very distressing realities of being a patient or a healthcare worker like John, it underscores not just the vulnerabilities of our system, but it highlights an urgent need for change. And I suppose there is only so much that the EU Beating Cancer Plan can do, because it can't change our health system, but it can complement our national policies. And lots of what's in the Beating Cancer Plan that John has articulated there is in our national cancer strategy. I think that the question is, how ready is Ireland? You mentioned 40 million there, and Minister Donnelly has given 2 years of funding of 20 million each year now for our national cancer strategy. But what difference is that making in terms of the delivery of healthcare on the ground? Because, you know, John is obviously working in a system that there is insufficient capacity, and there are too few.
But what John said there is that the historic mistake that was made in kind of a scattergun approach to cancer care, but instead of having a couple of centres of excellence. Because here's the rub. I mean, those beds in cancer special hospitals would not be affected by COVID, except insofar as you mightn't be able to admit someone who had COVID. But those beds could not be borrowed for COVID. Do you know what I mean?
That is a central point, that we do not protect the cancer pathway, and it's very vulnerable to emergencies and unscheduled care, and particularly in the case of surgery. And in our pre-budget submission, that's exactly what we were calling for, was the dedicated infrastructure for cancer services. And the Comprehensive Cancer Centre is included in the National Cancer Strategy, but we don't feel that it's being prioritised, that it's being moved forward, and like the progress is.
But isn't it a bit like these technical universities that exist on three or four different campus sites? You know, it's not the same as actually having a university on one compact site. That's the issue. Or having multidisciplinary medical centres which are virtual. In other words, it's not in a building. People aren't together, but they can be assembled when the need is there. That kind of scattergun approach to cancer, John Crown, gives the impression there is centralised care when there's not. We may have lost John. We may have lost
John. I'm here.
John.
I'm here, sorry. Okay. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. The question of that not having centralised care, but giving the illusion, if you like, of a centrality when, in fact, that centrality is virtual.
I'm sorry, can you hear me, Pat?
I can hear you, so please go ahead.
So, I beg your pardon. I am sorry. No, I thought you'd... honestly, the problem you see is it's very hard to see this except in the context of the wider problems with the health service. There was a sort of I'm not going to trivialize this, but there was a sort of a whack-a-mole approach. As problems crop up in the health service, as they get high profile, as a few scandals are reported, as we start drifting into paraphrase a phrase which was used in other contexts, you know, the politics of the last healthcare atrocity, and suddenly, you know, something becomes a big issue and we invest a certain amount of money and we cut a few ribbons and open a few centres and have a plan and a strategic group, you know, you have to see the problems of the fundamental service. The support services which cancer patients require are general medical, general surgical, radiology, pathology services, and these are all grotesquely deficient. Now, we have had a major investment and an increase in the number of cancer specialists, radiation, medical and surgical oncologists. We're still very low by international standards. But I can tell you right now that quality of care includes access to care. Quality care, care delayed is care denied. There's nothing high quality about care that you have to wait unconscionably long for. And the grotesque deficiencies in our diagnostic services, I mean, I'm not going to personalize this to any institution because our own isn't doing real well on it either, but you just consistently hear these stories of people waiting months and months and months for tests and scans. Now, certainly you can triage an emergency one, and rapid access clinics have been set up which have gone some distance, but inadequately, I believe, to addressing the need of those who may have a newly diagnosed cancer and getting them into the system quickly. But when you get into the system, when you're on treatment, I would say that I'm now spending literally a half an hour a day apologizing to patients about delays in their scans. You know, they don't meet the people in the administrative department of radiology. They meet me. They want to know, you told me I'd be getting scanned every 3 months. I'm waiting 5 months. Why is that happening? Yeah. Why is it 6 months? Why can they not tell me when the scan will occur? But, you know, when you're talking about people getting appointments, I had a patient recently. I received a letter from another colleague, and I was looking at it, and I said, this rings a bell. I remember sending that patient. I sent the patient 3 years ago. The waiting list to see this person was 3 years. And getting outside of the cancer arena, we heard the story a few weeks ago of the child who was given a pediatric appointment, which would have been actuated when they were sometime in their 20s. I mean, this is a grotesquely abnormal health system, and the cancer system exists within that. And it's all very well to have very aphoristic and well-meaning EU directives, but we have to fix the fundamentals of the system. Right.
John, briefly looking at the headlines about 1,800 health staff out due to COVID, I mean, it seems incredible that that should be the case. Is it down to, you know, vaccine waning and all that sort of thing? Or are there people who still don't go for vaccination within the healthcare system? But are you feeling the impact of this?
I think there's more testing going on. I think people's threshold appropriately is lower for testing people with respiratory symptoms. I don't know the specifics of that figure. Is it all people who were out sick themselves, or were they out sick because they were in isolation because a family member was a close contact? I had to work from home 2 weeks last year when I was a close contact of a family member who had COVID. Thankfully, I didn't get it, and thankfully, my family member was not very sick. But I had to not go into the hospital for 2 weeks. Now, as it happened, I was able to do many of my duties from home. Some I could not, and my colleagues kindly stepped into the breach. But all of these things are putting huge strains on the system, which, Pat, as you and I have discussed many times over the years, and you've been a great advocate for the health service. You deserve great credit, not just for the prominence and the high-quality scientific coverage you've given COVID at a time when many media outlets were going all tabloid with it. You've really focused on the science, and you've also given a great focus for highlighting problems with the health service, but there's no redundancy in our system. So we had, thankfully, despite the awful tragedies that COVID visited on individual families and, you know, many thousands of our citizens who died and people who were bereaved, the actual quality of the viral pandemic could have been so much worse. If this virus had been like SARS or MERS, very similar viruses, but with much higher mortality rates, we would have had absolute chaos. And hearing the head of the HSE talking about the problems of the ICU bed shortage, and he's right, and he really has done a great job trying to keep things on the road during COVID. But it has to be said, the reason that one third of our beds are full of COVID patients is we don't have enough ICU beds in the first place. We're on the bottom of the scale for ICU beds in OECD countries. And this didn't happen by accident. It happened because it was policy. It was deliberate. It was decisions made by men that we would run our health system in this way. And it's being unmasked now.
John Crown, Professor John Crown, and before that, Rachel Morrow, thank you very much. Both will be speaking at today's IIEA Janssen webinar, which starts at 1 and is free to join. Go to IIEA.com/events for details.